We talk to authors pretty much daily here on the JX, so that's a vote for the continued relevance and importance of books. Books are a central feature of a new work of fiction by Anthony Doerr, who takes us to places remote in both space and time in his latest novel, Cloud Cuckoo Land. Anthony Doerr has been writing for a long time, both short stories and novels. His previous two novels are About Grace and All the Light We Cannot See, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 2015. Anthony's in our corner of the country. He lives in Boise, Idaho. Anthony, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me. And congrats on the end of fire season. We feel that same joy here in Boise as well.
Yeah, such a relief, I could believe. That's right. You got the interagency fire center for the whole country in that part of in your town there. So let's talk about the Pulitzer euphoria. How long did that last?
Well, that was a really special night. We were in Paris, actually, mm-hmm. when we found out. So I think they announced it maybe noon or 1 p.m. Eastern time, but it was the evening for us, and it was just the four of us, my wife and two kids, and yeah, that was a really lovely moment for sure. And of course, it carries on, but there's also this imposter syndrome that rises up. You know, if you're sitting yeah. on an Alaska Airlines flight and you can't finish the easy level Sudoku in the back of the magazine, all I can think is a Pulitzer Prize winner fails at easy Sudoku.
There's your headline, yeah. So was there an idea for Cloud Cuckoo Land, or maybe even more than an idea, by the time you finished All the Light We Cannot See?
Absolutely, yeah. Good transition. So All the Light We Cannot See, some readers may know, set maybe 60% is set in this town in Brittany, France, called Saint-Malo during the Second World War. That is an old medieval town that has about 2 kilometers of medieval walls around it. It's an old walled town. And it was really my first exposure to reading about the history of walls. It also formed this tiny segment of Hitler's vast megalomaniacal project to build this thing called the Atlantic Wall, this series of fortifications down the entire coast of Norway and Finland, down through Denmark and Belgium, all the way to the Franco-Spanish border, really a 2,000-mile-long project, millions of tons of concrete. Really, all the texts that I would read that discussed the history of walls and defensive walls would mention the walls of Constantinople, which stood for 1,000 years. They withstood 23 sieges. There were these amazing triple walls, like a 50-foot-high inner wall, then this killing field, then an outer wall, then a moat. And they were really the preeminent defensive technology of the medieval world. And I knew nothing about them. I didn't grow up in Idaho. I grew up in Ohio, and in high school, you know, we went through Western civilization, but we kind of sped from the end of the fall of the Roman Empire immediately to the Renaissance in about 6 seconds.
Wow.
And so, you know, I love to use my work as a way to learn, just like your job. You know, you get to spend your day
yeah.
educating yourself about things. And so I just started really at the very end of finishing All the Light We Cannot See by reading about the walls of Constantinople. And that was my entry into this big, strange new book, Cloud Cuckoo Land.
All right, so the walls of Constantinople figure prominently with a couple of the characters. We'll talk about them in a minute. I want to bring out the characters sort of as a you know, sort of a stage introduction here. But just in general, did the idea grow in complexity, or did you always intend several intertwined storylines?
Yeah, I think it grew in complexity. Great question. Wasn't really, you know, when you feel that electric sense that you're onto something, that this energy that can sustain a years-long project. It wasn't until I was reading about how this 1,000-year reign of Byzantium really allowed the walls around the capital, Constantinople, allowed it to accumulate crazy wealth. The best example I can give is that the Hagia Sophia, this huge church that still stands in Istanbul now, it had about 4 acres of gold mosaic in its vaulting. You know, visitors to the city would just be mind blown, like the invention of the exclamation point, basically, from all these travelers to Constantinople. But it wasn't until I learned about book culture there, the way those walls protected libraries, so that as copies of ancient texts, especially from Rome and Greece, were decaying all over Northern Africa and Europe through the Middle Ages, copies were being preserved and recopied by hand every 100 years or so by monks and school teachers inside of the city of Constantinople. That's when I thought, okay, I've got something. So the complexity of the novel really started to stem from really just kind of trying to understand how story survives through time and how just little decisions, like one monk decides not to scrape a text off, which could be the last existing copy of Aristotle or Aeschylus or Sophocles or Euripides or Sappho, and instead decides to recopy it so that worms and algae and mold and fires don't get it for another 100 years. That was when I felt like I had that energy to sustain another long project.
Wow, that's an amazing story, and an amazing story about stories and the way in which we preserve them. And in fact, the book is just out, your book, but the title, Cloud Cuckoo Land, is an old concept. Tell us the story of the original.
Yeah. Had you heard that phrase before?
I had not, actually.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, I think that's common. Most Americans don't seem to know it, but it's funny. It seems more common in British and Irish English. The phrase vastly predates English, of course. 2,400 years ago, there was a comic playwright named Aristophanes working in Greece. You know, in high school, we read the Odyssey and we read Oedipus Rex, and that was really all I had in terms of my classics education. So I always felt a little insecure about how little I knew when somebody would talk about King Priam or something. So I just decided to start trying to rectify my ignorance about that and start reading, you know, the Odyssey again and the Iliad and all these myths. And so it wasn't until maybe I was a year into the project that I started reading Aristophanes. We have 7 of his plays left, although he wrote dozens upon dozens. And this one play, 2,400 years old, called The Birds, is kind of the original buddy comedy. These two guys decide to leave Athens because they say there are too many lawyers in Athens. And they go into the wilderness, and with the help of the birds, who are immortal, they found a new city in the sky, halfway between the realm of humans on Earth and the gods in the heavens. They believe they can intercept messages between the two. And so it's really maybe the first utopian story written down in Western literature, and they call this place Cloud Cuckoo Land.
So this original concept of Cloud Cuckoo Land is in a place then between humans and gods.
That's right, Jeffrey. Yeah, and you know, like most utopian stories, it doesn't quite work out for these two fellows who, you know, found a dream of this better place. But of course, once they get there, humanity inserts itself, and they start eating the birds who helped them build this city. And one tries to claim power over the other, and it's a classic kind of utopia devolving into a dystopia story. But as I was working on this book, the book took me 7 years, and you know, my boys—we have twin boys—they were between 10 and 17 the time I was working on it. Seemed like every time I'd go downstairs on the TV, there was another dystopian story, another planet exploding or another, you know, city on fire while superheroes are zipping around. And I just wondered, first, what it's doing to them to take in so much dystopian narrative. And second, what it would mean to explore utopian questions in a novel. You know, what does it mean to dream of a better place free from suffering? And why in so many human cultures throughout time have we told stories like that? So I thought I'd try to have each of the 5 characters try to all dream of a better place and kind of go on this circular journey where they travel somewhere, see if they can find a better place, and then return home.
Before we get to the 5 characters, I want to start with Ethon. Who and where do we find Ethon in time and space?
Yeah, so there's so many texts that have been lost from the ancient world, and really about, we have about 65,000 texts left. 50,000 of them survived because of Byzantine copies, because of those walls of Constantinople. So I have a character named Anna who finds what might be the very last copy of a very old book called Cloud Cuckoo Land. It wasn't until I learned that novels were written in the ancient world, long prose tales, were written 2,000 years ago. And so I invent one that was lost by a writer, a real writer named Antonius Diogenes, but all of his work has been lost. Apparently, he was a very creative writer who loved to mix up existing genres. He mixed up, you know, history and myths and romance and travel narratives. And so I thought it would be fun to try to invent a novel in the spirit of one of his works that have all been lost. So I invent this story inside my book called Cloud Cuckoo Land. And the main character is this guy named Aethon who sees, he's drunk, he sees Aristophanes' play, The Birds, being performed, and mistakes Cloud Cuckoo Land for a real place and goes on a series of misadventures to try to get there.
And kind of a case study in being careful what you wish for.
That's right. That's it. Absolutely.
All right. So you've mentioned Anna by name a couple of times. So Anna and Omir are more or less in the same time and place, but with some major dividing points, principally the walls of Constantinople.
That's it. You got it. Yeah. Anna, the girl inside the walls, living in a time when, of course, girls were not encouraged to become literate, but she's basically an indentured servant working in an embroidery house. There's incredible examples of Byzantine embroidery that still survive. And just every time I'd see them, I would think, you know, what was the life of these women like when they were trying to make these usually ecumenical garments? Tiny, tiny stitches, much smaller than a grain of rice, and you know, obviously long before electric lights. You know, what is that life like? So I knew that I probably wouldn't last long, and so Anna has a lot of me in her. She's dreaming of going to other places, and she uses story as a kind of escape. And then Omir is drafted in the Ottoman army. These walls that have stood for so long are finally disrupted by a new technology, just like in All the Light We Cannot See, which is really a story about radio, the technology we're using right now, this amazing invention in the 20th century to send voices over distances through walls that really disrupted existing power structures in Europe in the 1930s and 40s. The same thing was happening in Europe in the 1400s when the printing press arrives around the same time gunpowder arrives. So gunpowder gets embraced by a very young 19-year-old Ottoman sultan who decides to forge these big mega cannons, drag them to the walls of Constantinople, and see if he can make those walls, that old technology, obsolete once and for all. And Omir is a part. He's an ox herd who his oxen help drag one of these really heavy cannons to the walls.
So, and Omir has a relatively decent life, despite the fact that he is kind of turned away pretty much from childhood.
Yeah, he's born with a cleft palate. And so I just started researching that as well. I fell in love with how interesting, what surgical repair has allowed in the past 60, 70 years for people born with cleft palates versus the superstition and discrimination against folks who were born. You know, it's just a simple birth defect that is just very human, but so often was attached to these superstitions and just real cruelty. So, Omir has that difference, and that maybe allows him to make a really pivotal choice later in the novel that I won't give away.
Okay. Anthony Doerr is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest novel is Cloud Cuckoo Land. And so from Istanbul in the 15th century to modern-day Idaho, who are Seymour and Zeno, and what brings them into contact?
Yeah, so when I was trying to understand how to really dramatize the simple act of stewardship that Anna and Omir make when they collaborate to save this old text, saved from the walls of Constantinople, from the city of Constantinople, I began to think the only way to really dramatize that is to show that arrive in the lives of people who will live on the earth long after those characters are gone. So I looked for another era in which big technological upheaval had arrived and disrupted existing power structures. And for me, that's now. That's the information age. That's this huge, rapid acceleration in access to information and disinformation that's happening right now. So I invented two characters living now, Zeno, an octogenarian, who's leading children in a play adaptation of a little library in a rural town I've invented in Idaho, but much like many of the rural towns in Northern California and Southern Oregon that your listeners are in. And then I have Seymour, who's a teenager who's very connected to the natural world and distraught when a forest behind the house where he grows up is destroyed and taken down for development purposes. So those two intersect, and the story of Cloud Cuckoo Land entered their lives in the present day.
Now, Zeno's got a bunch of skills. What is the focus of his work?
He's a Korean POW, and he's a snowplow driver, but the skill that's most relevant to the novel is he's a translator. He learns to read ancient Greek while he's a POW and pursues that later in life. And so he's, it was really a good reminder for me of what translators are. And I think, you know, every generation needs a new translation of these old stories so that they get re-injected with life, with the newness of contemporary language. Because I remember reading the Odyssey in high school. We read like a translation from the 20s, and it all felt so kind of stilted and foreign to me. But when you read it, like, there's a new translation, for example, by a woman named Emily Wilson of the Odyssey, and it makes it so vivid and muscular and active and And you realize this is the basis of so many stories that we've been taking in since we were kids. So Zeno plays that role for this old story, Cloud Cuckoo Land. He's a translator.
And is the Odyssey your favorite book?
It might be. It's certainly a big part of this book. You know, that journey home, nostos, it's called, which is the root of nostalgia.
Mm-hmm.
It just means a homecoming. And really, there's something so special about, you know, this story about undergoing all these trials to try to return home. And the fact that the song is still being sung, you know, this is an oral tradition that people in the ancient world, long before writing, would perform in squares. It was like the Netflix of 3,000 years ago. You know, somebody comes into a square and they can recite this song and they can riff on it and improvise. And that song is still being sung in so many of the stories we see, in so many of the Disney stories our kids will watch on TV, this journey out with a circle, with a return home at the end. The hero comes back changed in some way. So I think almost all Western storytelling is in some kind of conversation with the Odyssey.
I thought my eyes had gone funny until I realized that Zeno's translation gets its own font in the book. Was it your idea or an editor idea, or where'd that come
from?
That's
a good... Yeah, I wondered about that too. That's definitely the book design. There's a whole job whose job is to do the book design, not the cover, but the actual font and layout. And I thought, okay, at first I was like, oh, I don't know about this. But yeah, Zeno's translation, there are 24 pieces scattered throughout the novel, and they're rendered in a different font in the print version of the book.
Anthony Doerr, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest novel is called Cloud Cuckoo Land. It is the follow-up to his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, All the Light We Cannot See. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Visit with Anthony about his work, this and the others. 800-838-3760 by phone, 800-838-3760, or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Okay, another character we haven't met yet, Constance, who does not even live on the Earth. Let's start with why. She's not on the Earth.
Yeah, I decided this was like a scary moment. Maybe 2 years into this project, I decided I'm also going to have this text land in the hands of somebody in the future. Not really something I'd taken on very much in my work previously, but I decided that the kind of tripartite structure of past, present, and future work. And I thought the more I started to read about artificial intelligence and climate chaos, just, you know, what all of us, you know, all your listeners right now went through this summer with smoke everywhere, mm-hmm. with increasingly dry and hot summers, you know, that's what we're living through. And I wanted to try to ask questions about that. I felt a responsibility to ask questions about that in my next book. So I have Constance living in the future. She's on a spacecraft with just a few, maybe 80 other human beings. And she has very little intersection with the natural world. It's all virtual. And so I just tried to show, in a sense, how this story reaches her and how the natural world changes through the progression of these centuries in the novel. You can see birds flowing over the heads of Anna and Omir in the 15th century. And Seymour is really dealing with the loss of a bird in his life, this really important owl to him, in the 21st century. And then here is Constance in the future, and all of her intersections with the non-human world happen virtually.
So there's always a concern, and sometimes a very real one in the case of Constance, about what's going to happen to the world around us. This is a constant concern of human beings.
Absolutely. Really, this novel, the whole novel of Cloud Cuckoo Land, works along this kind of continuum between stewardship and conservation and destruction and erasure. And I think of that in terms of human culture and books and libraries, and I think of it in terms of the natural world around us, too. And so Constance's sections in particular were a way for me to ask questions and try to suggest, you know, a possible future for all of us, for our kids and our grandkids, if we don't start making decisions in the next decade. I really feel like the next decade is a pivotal decade for to not overstate it, but for the future of our whole species.
Was Constance, you mentioned Constance kind of came in a couple of years into the project. Was she the part that also incurred the most rewriting? Because you couldn't research the future, obviously.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I grew so much respect for science fiction writers. When I have Zeno or Seymour turn around in the 21st century and look at a kitchen, you know, the reader and I can easily imagine mm-hmm. cupboards and a refrigerator, and we don't have to work so hard with our imagination, but with continence, you have to invent everything. You have to figure out what she might be eating and what her shoes would look like, how she might use the English language, you know, a century or a century and a half from now. So I had a lot of fun, but also a lot of challenges with rendering her sections persuasively, for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I heard the original, just heard the outline of Cloud Cuckoo Land, it reminded me instantly of a book I read in the 80s called The End of the World News by Anthony Burgess from 1982, also about people having to leave the Earth and a couple of other stories intertwined with those. I wonder if you'd ever run across that in your travels.
You know, I haven't. I just wrote it down when you said it. That's very interesting. But okay, yeah, there is a little genre of that story. You know, it's another version of the Cloud Cuckoo Land story, obviously, and I'm trying to play with that on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. But this idea that, oh, you know, Earth is failing us. Let's travel somewhere else and find a better place. And, of course, I don't want to give away too much, but I think the message ultimately of this novel is this is what we've got. This is as good as it's going to get. And we need to stop thinking about our immediate pleasures and start thinking about the future generations, because we're connected in so many ways to our ancestors and to the great-grandchildren who we're never going to get to meet.
And so there's Constance, who represents that those great-grandchildren will never get to meet, celebrating a 10th birthday, in a sense. Why is the 10th birthday on this ship, the Argos, so important?
Oh, yeah, good question. So that is Library Day, and I'm playing with libraries all throughout the book. And really, it goes back to the Enlightenment, this promise of Enlightenment thinkers, when they thought, if we can just get knowledge to every citizen, then they'll make educated decisions and the human race will be improved. And yet what we're seeing now is very interesting, you know, with Wikipedia, for example, this sort of comprehensive encyclopedia. It's not quite happening the way we think it is. You know, it's not necessarily making us any wiser. We often just feel overwhelmed by these tides of information flowing past us. So the library on this in this place where she is, called the Argos, this library is seemingly infinite. And yet she learns as she gets older it may not be as comprehensive as she thinks. And there are certain things that don't exist in the library that only really a human can have. So in many ways, I'm not a skeptic about technology, but I am asking questions about what can technology, and in the case of Constance's sections, what can AI offer us that, you know, that humans, you know, humans can really only fill certain needs for each other. And the promises of AI to be all powerful aren't quite, I believe, going to fill every need that a human needs.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the fact that AI only really knows as much as we tell it.
Yeah, and they might be able to, you know, contain every symphony, every baseball game ever played, a record of every football match ever played. But at a certain point, Constance needs more than that. She needs more than just access to information. She needs human connection. And for reasons I probably shouldn't spoil, she's isolated on, and she needs this story. She needs some kind of human connection that this infinite library can't quite offer her.
And Sybil, who I'm going to guess is, you know, Siri's great-granddaughter, tries, but, you know, because she's AI, she can't quite get there.
That's perfect, yeah. Yeah, and in some ways, when you're asking about research, you can research the future in that. It's really interesting to read these futurists, and some are just so bullish on the promises of AI. There are, you know, of course, amazing the way they could say, for example, collate, you know, data on cancer studies in a way that a single human could not. Maybe, you know, very simple tasks in terms of executing legal documents that could all be done much more inexpensively by AI. But this promise that AI is going to be able to solve, you know, these really complex human problems, I'm skeptical about that anyway.
It seems like, Anthony, you would have had quite a few choices in how you wrote the book. I mean, is it written in the order presented, or did you work on each story independently and then braid them together? You mentioned that Constance, the character in the future, on the ship speeding to a new home because we wrecked Earth, came in a couple of years later. So what was the order of events in writing the book otherwise?
Great question, because often I'll get this, especially from beginning writers. First, let me just say there are as many ways to do it as there are writers. But in my case, I rarely will work in the order in which a reader will read a text, whether it's a short story or a novel. Often I'm working all over the place, just in the way when you go for a walk, you kind of want to know how far you're going and what your destination will be. I'm often working on the ending or connective tissue bridging sections long before I've written the middle of the book. So in this case, with five different narratives to try to keep going, once I had realized I was going to go for it, set it in the future and the present and the past, I decided to kind of keep all five murals wet, if I can use that metaphor, the paint wet on all five. So usually I would try to go only 2 or 3 days working on just one character. It was often really dependent on what I'd be researching. You know, if you're reading about what meals the Ottoman army was eating in 1453 as they marched on Constantinople, then I'd be working on Omer sections. But within a couple of days, I'd make sure I'm back to AI or, you know, gardening on spacecraft. And what does that look like? So that I could keep my subconscious kind of active on Constance's section. So I think that's, for me, the most effective way. If you leave something, even just to, say, take a break for Thanksgiving, sometimes ice kind of forms over the project. So I try to work 7 days a week, even if it's just for 20 or 45 minutes some of those days when you're really busy doing other things. Because that way, I think when you're doing the dishes or walking the dogs, that project stays alive in your subconscious and you start solving those problems in other parts of the day.
You know, it's interesting because you strike a chord with me in particular about the research part of this, because there are so many things that I learn in researching for interviews and so many things obviously that you learn in trying to put a book together. But then you also have to realize there are times when, okay, if I spout this fact now, it's only going to make me look clever, but to no particular good advantage here. So there must be a bunch of things you had to toss out that it was like, oh, I know all this great stuff about Constantinople, but it's got no place in the story.
That's a really astute comment. Yeah, especially with historical fiction, especially with All the Light We Cannot See. You know, I'm working 10 years on that project. There are so many things written about and during the Second World War, and you fall in love with certain things you learn. And for example, I learned that Canadian paratroopers right around D-Day were jumping out of airplanes with fold-up bicycles on their backs. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so cool. I'm like looking up diagrams of fold-up bicycles. And, you know, and then I realized after 4 days of trying to write a scene with which this happens, I don't have any Canadian characters. Like, there's no reason for me to be including them in the novel, but I just got so excited about learning something. The novelist Andrea Barrett once gave me this great piece of advice. She said, a piece of fiction is like a cup of warm tea you want to hand to your reader. When you're harvesting all the tea leaves, you kind of fall in love with them. You're like, oh, this one's pretty. I want to make sure this goes in my tea. But at the end, you need to make sure you strain all that out so that she doesn't get, you know, tea leaves all in her teeth. So often it's a way of, you know, you kind of get really enthusiastic about something you learn, but later you have to remember it's okay if that doesn't make it into the novel. It helps kind of color the atmosphere of the novel. But there's a real kind of American worship of efficiency. And in research, sometimes you have to remember, research is never going to be efficient. It's always this kind of garden of forking paths. And it's okay if you just learn something. It doesn't mean it has to necessarily make it into the final product.
Yeah, you can identify all the weeds, but you don't necessarily have to keep them all.
Right, exactly.
We have an email from Wiley, south of Talent, and Wiley wants to know, I rarely stop reading long enough to question an author's choices, but why did you give Zeno's ending away barely halfway through the book? Thanks for this book and All the Light We Cannot See.
Oh, that's nice. I totally get that, and I have had that question before. I don't want to spoil too much, and I am grateful that the questioner didn't spoil it either. There was something, Constance has to learn this. She's researching in this big virtual library. She's kind of the puzzle assembler in this novel, and so I felt like this was something she had to learn. It was a big, tricky decision for me, and I've had that question multiple times. But I think ultimately, I hope a reader still turns pages to figure out what happens to Zeno happens without losing interest, just because I think we're all turning pages to find out what will happen, but ultimately we're also interested in why what happens. And so that's part of the joy, I hope, in turning pages of a novel.
Zeno as the puzzle assembler, that's an interesting concept, because I know from reading other descriptions and reviews of Cloud Cuckoo Land, people talk about that process. But what is it like for you as the creator of it all to try to bring this all together? I mean, when you talk about keeping the paint wet on all the murals at the same time, at some point you got to go, okay, I'm finished here. I got to draw these together now.
Exactly. You're all kind of always oscillating between macro and micro when you're a novelist. You're working on sentences where you need to figure out exactly what a character might say to one another, what the sky looks like in that moment, what they're wearing. So 70% of the day, you're just working in little details. And then there's these other moments when you have to step back and take almost a cosmic view of the project and work in these macro levels and ask yourself, what is this about? What questions am I asking about humanity? And in the case of this, what architecture am I building here? What is the shape of this thing? So often for me, those come in the evenings. I'll print out these little chapterettes, these small chapters that I work in, and lay them out on the carpet and try to understand how they function together. So that was really when I became more of a puzzle solver, more of the reader. So, you're moving all the time between kind of the writer and the reader, because ultimately your goal is that a woman in Ashland who you've never met and could never meet is going to be able to make sense of this thing. And you can't tap her on the shoulder and say, oh, no, you're missing this. Like, no, you're getting that wrong. So every day, hopefully, even though it's a kind of a hitching progress, every day you move a little closer to making the puzzle something that she can assemble on her own without your help.
But that's interesting, and it really is a physical process at times, and laying things in order, like this goes over here and this will go over here.
Absolutely. And sometimes I'll draw drawings. I often saw this as a series of concentric circles or spheres in which, Constance is in the middle inside her little vault, and then there's these kids trapped in this rural public library in Idaho in the next circle. And then Anna and Omir, Anna's trapped inside the walls of Constantinople in the outer circle. Maybe in the middle of the circle is this Aeson story, the Cloud Cuckoo Land story. So often, I'll in some way try to render visually the structure of things so that I can kind of get my head around what they are.
Well, the original version of that question was, do you keep a murder board or something with strings attached to people or something?
Yeah, I think that there is something to that. I think, all art making is really structure in some way. So I'm always interested in how people conceive of structure and how they pull their projects together. So yeah, that's part of it.
We talked about the environmental level of destruction that is present in all the stories, that people are driven forward by the fact that the world as they knew it has changed. And I wonder, particularly in the case of Constance on her rocket into the future on the Argos, whether her companion, her AI companion, Sybil, is I don't know, an environmentalist AI figure or something, whether she's really drilling stuff into Constance and the other people on the ship about making sure you take care of the next place.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm asking questions. There's a human librarian also on the ship named Mrs. Flowers, and at a certain point she says to Constance, we are the bridge generations. This journey, if it was ever even physically possible, and it probably will not be, to send something as heavy as a human being all the way outside the solar system, it would obviously take more than one generation. So the idea is that this journey takes so long that there's a series of bridge generations before you can ever reach the destination. And for me, that just functions as a metaphor for all of us, what we are on this planet, our bridge generations. And so I think when she says, when Mrs. Flowers says to Constance, we're the bridge generations, we're here to protect and preserve what we can, so that when the people can finally reach this destination we're going to, they'll have human culture intact. And so I think I am trying to say there is a real culture on board that little ship of preservation and conservation. And I think that's true in each of the five characters' stories.
That is a concept that's always fascinated me, the idea of generational interstellar travel, intergenerational interstellar travel, where the people who are alive when the ship launches are not the same people who are going to be on board when the ship reaches its destination.
Right. And isn't that a metaphor for us, for our species, of course. Think about how much is lost and how rare it is that anything gets preserved. My grandmother moved in with us when I was 14, and she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. I had never even heard the phrase before. And over the next couple of years, I watched dementia steal everything that she was, her sense of humor, her ability to sing songs and play cards, and her ability to care for herself and feed herself. And so I think I've always been infected with this idea of the fragility of memory, this terror that, you know, of course we're all going to be erased eventually. And so maybe we are all, in some ways, on this ship heading to a different place. And what's important is that we transmit through story or through song or through just love to the next generation what matters to us so that they can carry it forward to the next generation.
I noticed in your recommended reading list at your website, Anthony, that you recommended Tor Hansen's The Triumph of Seeds. We had him on to talk about that book and about his earlier book about bees buzz. I mean, what do you look for in the works of other writers?
Oh, yeah, that book is a wonderful book about seeds. And Constance, in particular, is the metaphor of seeds play through a lot in her story. So that book was quite helpful. In the case of Hansen, curiosity. I'm almost always looking for curiosity. And the writers I fall in love with, they just seem to be endlessly curious people. And I love to be able to pick up a book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, and learn. And I think ultimately, reading has been a way for me to slip out of the confines of my own skull. And I try to really infuse that magic into this novel, too, this idea that stories help us slip the trap of our own self and live multiply, live other lives and live in other places and in other times. And I think anytime I'm feeling a little low or I feel like I'm too interested in my own problems, I realize that's probably because I finished a book and I haven't started a new one that's really gotten me engaged yet. So I do feel like reading for me is always a way to escape the life of the 47-year-old guy who goes to Albertsons in Boise, Idaho and buys chicken breast, you know? And it's not like I need an escape. I just think it's really important to kind of live multiple streams, and reading is the most effective way, I think, to do that.
I read one amateur review of Cloud Cuckoo Land that said, I wanted to give this 3.5 stars, but the frequency of tears and the swelling of my heart forced me to give it a 4.
Okay, great.
So, you mentioned already that you had to have some humility after winning the Pulitzer Prize for All the Light We Cannot See, not being able to finish the Sudoku on the Alaskan Airlines magazine. But was there some weight that you felt, though? It's like, I got to deliver again.
There are certainly moments that comes like late at night when you're like, oh my gosh, my publisher, that book was on the New York Times bestseller list for 4 years. And so, you wonder, like, am I going to be able to repeat that? Is my publisher depending on me to do something like that? But thankfully, writing is so engaging and storytelling is so engaging for me that after 5 minutes at the desk in the morning, usually those things kind of fade. I put on noise-canceling headphones without even music just to kind of cut noise out of my head. And usually within 5 minutes, the sentences are absorbing enough and the problems that I'm making for myself in the book are absorbing enough that I don't think about any of those expectations. I'm just trying to make the book that I want to make.
7 years of work, as you mentioned, on Cloud Cuckoo Land, which was just released recently. Again, the follow-up to All the Light We Cannot See, which won a Pulitzer Prize for Anthony Doerr in 2015. What a pleasure to visit. Thanks so much for joining us on The Exchange.
Oh, thanks so much, Jeffrey. Thanks for everything you do for your community.
All right, thanks. Take care.